This is tape one, side two, Gus Sheward interview, 11791.
I think Frank had, and this is again just a guess because we never, this is just based on behavior, behavioral characteristics that Frank exhibited that I saw. So it's right. Not the very best of evidence. And remember, at this point in my career, at least at the beginning of it, I was just one of the boys, although I did have the unique opportunity to work closely with Ed and Albert and a lot of other very good people, Alan Antoven and so on and so forth. And then as I grew and got into the economics department and became its deputy head and then its acting head, and then when I went to NATO, I got to know Frank much better. I think, first of all, he had a view of RAND as a mission-dedicated organization, a phrase I've probably used before. RAND's mission was to safeguard the national security of the United States. Initially, I believe he thought primarily, exclusively by working with the Air Force. Through internal pressures, I think he expanded that to include other defense agencies, but he didn't like it. In fact, he never, I think, liked the stuff that the relationships that the physics department developed with government agencies. He did not like the relationship with ARPA. I think he did not like the relationships that were developed at the DOD level. And if he'd had his druthers, Frank would have simply stuck with Project RAND as an Air Force thing. And I think his belief was that RAND was at its most effective when it was working on future-oriented, quantitatively analyzable, therefore scientifically recreatable problems that were coincidental with the interests of the Air Force. And I think that he was very pleased when it also turned out that the results were favorable to the interests of the Air Force. So that given two studies of equal quality, in my judgment, Frank was more likely to be pleased by one which said, yes, go buy that bag of gumdrops, rather than like you want to, rather than one that was equally good which says, keep your hands away from those gumdrops, they make your teeth rotten. What you really ought to be eating is all bran. I'm not attributing any sinister motives to him. Obviously, I think he had in at mind always the best interest of the institution as well as of the country. Secondly, Frank had a relationship with the East Coast defense establishment, as exemplified by Jerry Wiesner and others at MIT, and which affected his view of RAND research. He often thought, I believe, of RAND research as playing the role of a counterweight to the East Coast trader establishment. Those are very strong words, but I can remember his saying in my presence, I've forgotten whether it was to me, in my presence, that many of these people were just a bunch of traitors who would rather cave into the enemy than stand up to them and develop the capability to deal with them effectively. And he, therefore, that affected his taste in RAND research. He was more attracted to RAND work, interdisciplinary or not, which furthered that goal than he was to other work, which didn't. For example, Herman Kahn's work on civil defense. Civil defense was anathema to Frank. It was running and hiding from the enemy. And no matter how long and how hard you argued with Frank, and even if you got through to him and made your points about the value of civil defense and the strategic concept and so on, fundamentally, Frank felt that people who advocated that sort of thing were gutless or afraid to face the music or whatever, and I think that affected his taste. So, and I think that showed up in the poor relationship he had with Herman, especially after the publication of On Thermonuclear War, over which they had a huge row. And incidentally, I just turned over the original page proofs of that manuscript to Vivian. It may be the only copy left in the world of the original page proofs, which I just clung on to desperately. And that is the thing that I believe I referred to earlier, that Herman handed to Albert and asked him to review in my presence when I was in Albert's office. And several weeks later, when again, coincidentally, I was in Albert's office talking with Albert, Herman showed up, stuck his head in the door. You can't say he tiptoed in. He made his presence known, his immenseness known. Came in and said, "Albert, have you read my manuscript yet?" And at which point Albert said, "Yes, indeed, I have, Herman." And he had his foot on his desk. I remember it as clearly as if it were yesterday. He reached down into his bottom right-hand drawer, opened the drawer, pulled out the manuscript, threw it at Herman. So Herman had to catch it, and said, "Herman, there's only one thing to do with this manuscript." And Herman said, "What's that, Albert?" And Albert said, "Burn it." And so I found that a very interesting and impressive exchange, and a good way in which Rand reviewing of the informal type was sometimes rather hostile. Well, anyway, Frank, I think, shared that view, but for different reasons. And the book, of course, was published. In my opinion, it was a book well worth being published. I think it did a lot to stimulate thinking about this subject, much more good than harm, intellectual good than harm. And I was glad to see it come out of Rand. If Herman had done it at the Hudson Institute, I think it would have been a disgrace, because nobody would have told him to burn it, or fix it, or alter it, or change it. Whereas people at Rand were constantly after Herman to improve it and make it better, and pointing out things that were wrong with it. And he was malleable enough, barely, to accommodate many of his more serious reviewers. So I guess all this has to do with Frank's preference for research for the Air Force or otherwise in the national security interest, preferably quantitative or scientific, in quotes, in nature, so that it could be understood and could be recreated, which related to a strong Air Force interest. On balance, I think he had a preference for those studies which supported Air Force interests, although I'm unaware of his really intervening, and I don't know that he ever intervened and tried to change anything or whatever. And then he had this sort of anti-East Coast defense establishment bias. And he saw Rand and Rand's work as a counterbalance to that. Now, that's the best summary I can give off the top of my head.
Sure.
I think Frank was very honest about it. He, I guess, was not always completely straightforward about it, or at least I guess Herman would not have said so, or Albert would not have said so, because he sometimes resorted to trivial excuses to accomplish grand ends. For example, he would decide that so-and-so had to go, and he would wait until he used two napkins out of the restaurant instead of one and fire him for excess consumption or something. there have been cases like that. Where the alleged cause for dismissal had absolutely zero to do with the real cause for dismissal, and where people were exposed directly to Frank, and therefore he could go around department heads and get at them. And there were also department heads, and I think Hans was one of them. As you heard in the last history, the history that I moderated, the tape,
right.
Who saw his job as accommodating to Frank, whereas I saw a department head's job as resisting the front office and protecting the researchers from undue influence from the management. Hans viewed his job as making Frank happy. And that's just two different, entirely different views of the way things ought to be done. And we had both kinds of people here.
Yeah. I'm trying to kind of correlate your earlier comment about Frank reading everything he could get his hands on, and these broad kinds of views that he held, and how that translated into assessing a particular piece of work. Was it simply on those broad kinds of grounds, or did he take real interest in the methodological approaches, the validity of systems analysis, say, or you know, the tools that were brought to bear to study the kinds of problems that Rand was grappling with in this period?
I think that Frank felt, I think he was concerned with the methodology. I think Frank felt very torn about systems analysis. On the positive side, he saw it producing results which were extremely useful. The Bayes study, for example. He saw that it enhanced the capability to do interdisciplinary research, and he was in favor of that. So that those were two of the principal arguments in favor of his views of sort of systems analysis and innovation in methodological areas. On the other hand, I think Frank had an inherent mistrust of systems analysis. There was a man here named Fritz Salagar, and I can remember Fritz referring to the systems analysts as quote, and this is a quote, magicians. And he would define magicians as phonies who did nothing but pull the wool over people's eyes by confusing them with numbers and equations and so on and so forth, when any fool could see what the true answer was, to which people used to say, "Well, Fritz, you ought to know. You ought to know all the answers. So something, you have the qualifications to know all the answers." So some of these arguments were very, very, very bitter. And he also, I think, Frank, drew from the counsel of people like Salagar, the potential dynamite in the systems analysis technique for some of the Air Force's most cherished concepts. Salagar was in the government. He was the Air Force's advocate for the B-36. He viewed, Fritz was a Hungarian count or baron or something, who viewed hierarchy and loyalty as the greatest qualities in the world. Certainly they're not the worst. But his loyalty to the Air Force was so extreme that if they had told him to go jump off the George Washington Bridge, he would have killed himself trying to get there to do it in time. And so that any study that showed the risk of conflicting with an Air Force view, in Fritz's opinion, was a menace to mankind. And I think he was one of the people who would counsel Frank, because of his seniority, his government experience, and he may indeed have had an effect on Frank's view in that regard. So again, I think he was, being human, he was conflicted, and I think it's to his credit that under this conflicted individual, the development of this whole technique flourished, and he did not discourage it, and he did not, except in a few individual cases, and then it wasn't a technique, and it was, again, a more personal thing. Also, he didn't like systems analysts. He didn't like those people. There was something about them that sort of rubbed him the wrong way, again, in my judgment.
And we're talking about the...
Albert.
The leading practitioners.
Yeah, the leading practitioners. He didn't trust them. He didn't... Maybe it's because he didn't understand the technique. Maybe it's because he saw it threatening. Maybe it's because some of them were unpleasant. Really unpleasant. There's no necessary correlation between politeness and intelligence. I learned that very quickly as a young man, and that's certainly true with the Rand Corporation. There were some exceedingly unpleasant people around here who were of extraordinary brightness and productivity. So, and some of them were in the systems analysis area and led Frank to not like the people, and if he didn't like the people, then he wouldn't, that would kind of rub off on the work a little bit. Not very often on the point of getting him to intervene, but it would color his view, I think, from time to time. But again, I think it's to his everlasting credit that in spite of all this, I mean, look, Frank, under Frank, all these things were invented. They were, you had Ed Paxton down in the room flying his little airplanes on wires back and forth. You had the development of all sorts of analytical techniques. You had this tremendous variety of personalities, ranging, as I said before, from Williams to Barlow. One of them totally free enterprise. You get the best people you can, and you let them do whatever they want to do. And Ed, who was very demanding and tried to bring out the best in people in a systematic way by working with them and not bossing them around. He never did that, but he knew what he wanted, and he tried to get it in terms of a good, solid product without never specified the outcome. That's why he was so shocked when one of his trusted engineers said, "Oh well, if you want to change, I can do that easily. I'll just change everything around to accommodate you," which I think was the beginning of Ed's decision to leave Rand. I could see he didn't say anything, but I could see the look on his face when that was said to him, and I certainly felt it at the time. And throughout my tenure here, I've tried to get rid of people who were that malleable, who were always so accommodating. They want to produce what the client wants or the boss wants or whatever. I don't think Rand should be that sort of place.
Okay. Let's perhaps take an example where a number of these issues kind of interpenetrate, and perhaps the soft briefing that you mentioned earlier, in which recommendation about the B-70, which was going to be contrary to Air Force interests, would be a good one to look at. Surely before this briefing that you described that Barlow presented this to SAC came about, there must have been some internal vetting of the SOS briefing and the recommendations that were going to come out of it. Can you describe that process as you saw it, and what Frank's role was, and the role of Ed and his interest in putting forward a recommendation that he felt was based on the evidence?
Well, if my outstanding observation of it is trivial, and that is by the time the briefing was ready for internal review, we were all so exhausted that Ed got up and gave it, and I sat in the first row and fell asleep in his face. But it was reviewed here, and it was, at least I recall, as I recall it, Frank participated in the review, and Frank was convinced enough of the outcome of the sensible message that was being delivered that no matter how he felt about it emotionally, to my knowledge, he never publicly or privately, although he may have privately, I don't know, attempted to intervene and get that changed. which again is, to me, in my view, is to his everlasting credit, because it's the sort of thing he would have been basically, sort of intuitively hostile to. And he did not, as I say, ever publicly comment on that finding. He publicly commented on the study as being a very high quality effort. He publicly commented on the briefing as being a superb briefing, which it was. I think it was probably the best briefing that I've ever heard. It was really a masterpiece. And and I never heard him say anything negative about it. You know, it consumed a lot of time, it consumed a lot of resources, human resources, it consumed a lot of money. But it was interdisciplinary, and that pleased Frank. It had some of the other characteristics that I mentioned that he favored, which pleased him. And I think he just gritted his teeth and swallowed the conclusion he didn't like and backed Barlow to the hilt whenever it came to that.
Yeah. Given that you fell asleep in the briefing, this may be...
Well, I woke up from time to time. So maybe a rather dubious observation.
But was clearly it was evident to everybody who was listening to the briefing that some of the recommendations were going to be controversial. Was that an element of discussion among the staff, or was the discussion more along the lines of the logic of the presentation and the study and, you know, for firming up making your points valid?
Well, the first time that I recall it being presented, there were a lot of discussions. Ed had a little group who helped him put the briefing together.
Okay.
And that was a group of sort of people who were supposed to help put the briefing together, but at the same time criticize it and raise concerns about it. And that group, fell partly to me as sort of Ed's helper to participate in that. Bill Graham was in that. As I recall, Albert was participated from time to time. Al Ladder, I think, was in there from time to time. And maybe one or two others. And I've forgotten who they are now. And in those very small sessions, which would often involve a subset of the group instead of the whole group, with my usually being there because I was with Ed, so I would see what everybody had to say, those issues would be raised. But when Ed first gave the thing to Rand, in spite of the fact that I fell asleep at the beginning, as I recall, of the Rand audience, the Rand-wide audience that was assembled to hear this thing, was so impressed by it that at the end they applauded, which was an extraordinary thing to have happen. And then there were questions much more along the latter line, that is the substance and so on, rather than about the controversial nature, although I'm sure there were several people who said, Ed, I don't think you're ever going to get this briefing finished in front of some senior Air Force officials. And he gave it not only to SAC, but he gave it to Tommy White, who was then the chief of staff of the Air Force, and to the Air Staff. And in fact, I went back with him for that briefing. And he got a lot of trouble because he took on a lot of the Air Force's sacred cows, not just limited to the B-70. And it was really the first that I'm aware of, the first attempt to look into the future and say, no, you shouldn't do this, you should do this, across the board. The basing study was rather specific,
right,
relatively narrow compared to this. And so it generated a lot of controversy, and it got, of course, it quickly got outside Air Force circles, and it was used as evidence by others to get the B-70 canceled. And there was a fair amount of hostility about that. But again, to the Air Force's credit, they never came back. They never tried to get outside of criticizing the briefing. They did not exercise any muscle or any influence that I know of to have Rand change its conclusions. That would have been inconsistent with their view of the value of Rand. So, you know, a lot of people's tempers were short and their confidence was strained and relations were tense, but there was not, to my knowledge, any intervention, at least overt enough for me to see, on the part of the Air Force to get us to change things. So we played it out the way we saw it, and Ed did a magnificent job with the briefing. And as I say, sometimes it was about an hour, an hour and a half long, sometimes it would take him a half a day to get through it because of all the interventions, questions, hoots, hollers, general hostility on the part of his military audiences. But he did it, and I think it had an effect. I think it's ironic that the only copy of the briefing is somewhere unlocatable in my file, because I knew at the time it was a monument, and so I quietly secreted it away, and I assumed that Ed had done the same. I never asked him. I think there may even be an official publication, but it's not the. I think it's not the whole briefing.
I haven't been able to identify such a document. So yeah, you may have something unique.
I may have something unique. Yeah. Now you know there were other examples of Rand running counter to Air Force policy, and they weren't always so well behaved. I mean, there was you talk about the Bert Klein R&D effort, of which I was part. The Air Force was really terribly upset about that. I mean, it was as if we had deliberately set out to contradict them at every bend and turn or twist in the road of what they were doing. And they were very, very angry, and I'm told that they did send a delegation out to Frank and say, get rid of these guys. And Frank sent them packing. And to his credit, and as I think maybe I mentioned before, although I'm not sure, many years later I was at a meeting of the Air Force Advisory Group here in Santa Monica, where the generals were all patting themselves on the back for having thought up so cleverly this new approach to research and development, and I was the only one in the room who remembered that they had tried to fire me for making these suggestions many years before, of which I was indelicate enough to remind them. I said I didn't think they ought to take all the credit because some of the work was done by people at Rand like Bert Klein and others in the 50s and the 60s with the total opposition of the Air Force R&D community and with an actual attempt to try to, you know, do us in. Because we were so against the approach that the Air Force had adopted, and we were such a pain in the behind. And some of them recalled that there had been some controversy, but, you know, it's always better to let people think it's their own idea. I just couldn't resist having been put at risk. But that's one of the very rare instances that I'm aware of in which the Air Force has ever tried to intervene with Rand Research.
I'd like to follow that one a little bit because, as I understand the work of Bert Klein and that group, it involves some interesting issues. And I think the kind of the thrust of what I understand, you know, Bert's arguments were in this area of R&D management was that when you're trying to make development decisions about systems that haven't been built, which involve new technology, your first step ought to be to get enough information to make an intelligent decision.
Exactly.
That you make some investment in exploring what the basic technologies are before you go ahead and make a procurement decision. I guess the question would be, you know, how did that in your perception run counter to Air Force practice and handling of these matters? And secondly, it also tied in, at least in Bert's judgment, I think, to Rand's approach to systems analysis, in which there seemed to be a presumption of greater knowledge about being able to extrapolate based on a limited amount of information than he thought was appropriate. So if we could perhaps follow those two threads for a few minutes.
Well, obviously trying to sum up that work in one sentence as you did does oversimplify it.
Right.
And I would just add to it, to reduce the oversimplification somewhat, that we were arguing that as you said, you should develop a broad menu of new technologies far enough so that you could make a rational decision as to which technology to adopt for a certain mission. But that then you didn't try to put all these new technologies across the board together and commit yourself to buy it as a system. Rather, you tried various combinations of these in prototypes, and which you could sort of sum up by saying fly before you buy. And there was an element of competition in there among the aerospace firms, and an effort to get the message across that you should really, the best use of your money is to spend it on component development, and only then begin to try various combinations of components in various configurations to see which combination resulted in the best system. Whereas the Air Force, and then, only then, after the thing had actually flown or performed whatever it was supposed to do, so that it could be measured and observed and seen, was it time to make a procurement decision. Now, at the time, this was right at the beginning, of course, of the missile procurement era. And at the time, the Air Force was in a tremendous hurry and under tremendous pressure to procure large numbers of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And they developed an approach which they call the concurrency approach, which said essentially you go out, buy everything new at once under one contract or one combination of contracts for a final system, which implied that you knew how each of these components was going to perform in advance and that they could all be put together, and you would put them on the launching pad and off they would go. And off they did, and I have pieces of one of them in my cigar box over there. And that was the way to save time and not necessarily to save money, but their argument was that it was probably no more expensive to do it that way than to do it the way we were suggesting. And that's the way the Air Force did its missile development, the Atlas and the Titan, the Thor, sort of lined up everything and bought it all, made a big production commitment before they'd really examined any of the specific components or seen them perform or were in a position to make choices among, let's say, different approaches to guidance systems or whatever. They just bought the whole thing. And as they were doing that, this was very large and very public, and huge amounts of money were involved. And along comes Rand and says, that ain't the way to do it. And that gets people very irritated. And so that's what that struggle was all about. And I remember one paper that we did, which became, you know, it's kind of illustrative of the sort of hostility it generated. It was used by Senator McClellan. I don't know whether I mentioned this before or not. Gene Zuckert was Secretary of the Air Force at the time, and Gene Zuckert was giving testimony before, I guess, one of the Armed Services Committees, and McClellan was chairman of the committee at that point, and was conducting the hearing, and he asked Zuckert something like the following series of questions. Mr. Secretary, there's this outfit called the RAND Corporation that works for you. Zuckert said, yes, Senator. And Zuckert said, McClellan said, well, tell me, are they any good? Zuckert said, yes, sir, they are. And McClellan said, well, he said, I thought you'd say that because you're spending a lot of money out there. Now, if they're working for you and if they're good and you're spending all that money out there, and he reached under the thing that they were sitting at and pulled out a copy of our study, why don't you do what they say? And in a, you know, sort of figuratively beating Zuckert over the head with this report, which, as I recall, had to do with the prototype development, the role of prototypes in development. And the issue at hand, I believe, was the F-111, which was supposed to be, you know, all things to all men. And Zuckert's reply, I think, was masterful. He said, you know, Senator, he said, from the RAND Corporation, he said, we get all different kinds of reports and ideas. And he said, I would say some of those reports are really superb, and some of them are so-so, and some of them are not so good. To which McClellan replied, well, Mr. Secretary, how would you characterize this study? To which Zuckert replied, he said, Senator, I would call this study interesting. And the whole thing just sort of dropped, and they went on to the next subject. But it does illustrate how RAND work was used as a weapon against the Air Force and in the way it was going about things in this procurement area. Now, with regard to systems analysis, I think it's true that Burt and others were suspicious of many of the assumptions that were made because they didn't find them overlapping with the facts as they saw them. A trivial example, which I can give you at first hand. This goes back to the SOF study, but it was the kind of observation that Burt would make. The SOF study was coming to its close, and we were recommending a large buy of X. I've forgotten what it was. And we were trying to do this on a constant budget. So we assumed that the B-47 force was phased out on such and such a schedule, and that the savings from the phasing out of that force could then be used to purchase this new system. And it was only at the very end of the study that I happened to be the one who was reading that part of it, and I focused on it, and I looked at it, and I looked at it, and I looked at it, and I knew that something struck me as being, there's something wrong here. And I couldn't figure out what it was until all of a sudden I asked myself the question, what is he saying? He's saying that the B-47 force is sort of halfway or two-thirds of the way through phase out, and they haven't started yet. And indeed, that was the assumption that was used, and that's where the money came from. So I went to the guy who did this portion of the study, and I said, I found this assumption that you made in the study, which simply is not correct. We have not yet started to phase out the B-47 force, although surely we are going to do so. So you cannot really start counting the savings from having phased out a major part of the force in order to pay for X, whatever it is that we were recommending to be bought. To which I received the reply, oh my God, he said, you're right, but you know, he says, if I change that, I'll have to change everything. And I think the thing sort of got wiggled around and camouflaged and sort of was still in there when the final study appeared. Nobody ever noticed it. But I think it's that sort of thing that made Bert and me and a few others sometimes suspicious of systems analysis, because if you made an assumption and you did a whole set of things and the assumption turned out to be wrong, then people were reluctant to admit that they'd made the wrong assumption and do it over again. And that's what gave people like Salugar their ammunition, that this was nothing more than magic. You take a bunch of assumptions, you cloak them in numbers, you grind out these numbers, and you come out with a bunch of conclusions which are no better than the assumptions that underlie them, which I think is true. And of course, systems analysis at its best raises at least as many questions as it answers, and gives the decision maker a systematic way of thinking about the decision he has to make. He doesn't have to take the RAND conclusion. If there is a RAND conclusion, he can go on and use the methodology and plug in his own assumptions or plug in reality and reach quite different conclusions. And I think that's the valuable thing about systems analysis. But this reluctance to face up to potentially erroneous or mistaken assumptions, I think, is what underlay the hostility and suspicion that some people had toward systems analysis.
Okay. We're at the end of a side of a tape here.